Accession number 18463, Reel 40.
And he said, well, I'm just forming an anti-tank platoon. We've got a Wombat, which is a new thing. It's like a big rocket launcher on wheels. And as you've had a lot of experience with the 3.5 rocket launcher, this is only a bit bigger. I'll put you in charge of the anti-tank platoon and promote you to corporal straight away. So that was quite... I presume I'd have had to do my parachute training and all that beforehand. So I went back and... had a talk with John, and he said, well, you must volunteer first. And I had a nasty feeling now, because I knew he was reluctant to let me go. Well, he naturally would be, wouldn't he? He didn't want to lose a sergeant. So there was a bit of amin and ahrin, and I got the impression that if I had to volunteer in the East Surreys, and the feeling came over me, and I'm reasonably confident I was right, if I volunteered, they wouldn't release me to the para. So I left, and not disagreeably, but I just said, well, that's it. I think perhaps I'll leave and see what comes of it. Went into the Army Reserve. It was supposed to be an N Reserve, but mine had a P Reserve, whatever P Reserve was. I have no idea what it was at all. And this was a time about a year before the Suez Crisis. I was working down at St Albans. We were rehashing the Woolworths in St Albans. And the Suez Crisis was in November 56. And I came out of the store. We were having... This is the time of power cuts, incidentally. I came out of the store and looked outside, and there were all these troops going up. I don't know where they were going. Perhaps they were going up to Harwich or Liverpool or somewhere like that. Sand-coloured vehicles and armed to the teeth and all the rest of it. And I thought, I've got to get back in again, because, you know, this looks like it's going to go on a little bit. Because it was quite a harrowing time at that time. And I went on the December, I think about 2nd of December or something like that. I'd rung John up. Incidentally, in the meantime, of course, during this time I was out, he kept inviting me over there to anything that was going on, their evening do's, and I was shooting for him at Purbright and things like that in civilian clothes, or if not, they'd give me a suit of denims and I'd go down and shoot for him. It was a fairly good shot. And I said to him, well, I'd like to come back. And I did. And of course, they can't re-promote you, of course, straight away. But when a couple of... He gave me one stripe, more or less, straight away. And then I got... I don't think I was ever a corporal again. I think I went straight to sergeant and went up and saw the CO, who was still Buchanan, Colonel Buchanan. He had done two tours. Each CO did a three-year tour. But he, because he was so good and a lack, perhaps, of people who could replace him, he did 6 years, so he was still CO, though he was coming near the end of it at that time. And he interviewed me, and I was promoted back to sergeant again. And John White, my friend, who had been a sergeant when I was in D Company before, he'd been promoted to CSM, which is a well-deserved promotion. But unfortunately, one or two others... it wasn't quite the same. The National Service men were beginning to dry up, and we had this sort of, John and I called it medal mania, where if a guy had a load of medals, he would get promoted. That's how it seemed to us. I mean, I'm sure the CO or the company commanders probably looked in on it in merit, but there was one who had been an able seaman during the war in the KG-5, King George V battleship. And that went to virtually every port there was, and every port they went to, they got a medal, and they promoted him to CSM, and he was quite useless. But that's how we between us, we younger ones, looked on this as being medal mania. And it wasn't the same. There'd been amalgamations, and we got an artillery unit to come in, so the CSM was an artillery CSM. Our own, the old CSM having gone. And funny enough, one of the chaps who came was a sergeant who had been a stretcher bearer with six Surreys during the war and got the MM. And he was a good lad. Well, the CSM was a good lad as well. But they were factions now. It was never the same. And again, I think it was probably about this time when the CO, it was still in Buchanan's time, he called all the younger sergeants in and said, well, there's a crisis on at the moment. I can't remember what it was, except that Home Guard was reforming at that moment of time. And this crisis was developing, and for some reason or other he was expecting to mobilise virtually the following week. And he said, well, if we mobilise next week, I shall make all the sergeants second lieutenants and all the corporal sergeants, and that's how we'll control this situation, because they were still over strength, well over strength. I guess they were probably about 150 in a company, 120, 150 in a company, so they could have formed a division virtually overnight without any trouble at all. A battalion you could have formed literally over a weekend, and a new battalion in another weekend, providing you had the staff to do it. But this was dying down. The National Service was coming to an end, and they weren't coming in. And there were, well, career obviously was over. It was Kenya and things like that, you know. And I think probably some of us maybe didn't quite look on the fighting that was going on in Kenya as being a real war sort of thing, you know. But I'm sure those who were there did. Anyway, I went on then for until 19, I can't remember the year now, six Surreys. Yeah, that's right. We went on. Oh, incidentally, in the meantime, in 1959, East Surreys were disbanded and we became 4th Queen's Royal Surrey Regiment. That was in October 1959. And on the December 1961, I decided that I'd had enough. My son was beginning to, I mean, it was two or three or something like that, and I needed more time with him. But I was working away so much that I just didn't have the time. I didn't even have the time to go to camp. I had to get in evenings, so I'd only have 1 week's camp. Because at that time, incidentally, because you... We just got our 2 weeks paid holiday, so I'd take 1 week to camp, and got double pay, of course, sergeant's pay and civilian pay. But lots of people, we had lots of postmen, funny enough, because the post used to pay them for their 2 weeks camp, and with their 2 weeks army pay as well, they did quite well. And there were a number of services, fire service and things like that. I think the police did it as well, but obviously contracting. There was nothing like that. And just about that time, we had a letter came and a travel warrant, which was for use on mobilisation only. And that was issued about, I can't remember now, 4th of September 1961, it says. And... we were to go use this warrant to go to Billinghurst, Sussex, and on mobilisation. So there must have been another crisis or other, something or other was going on at that time. I left then at 2nd December 1961. I left the TA completely and went into the Army General Reserve. That started on the 3rd of December 1961. And by a strange coincidence, I was attached to the Spearhead Battalion, which happened to be 1st Middlesex at that particular time. And they were at Lee Metford Camp, Lydd, Kent. And we had our ticket and everything for mobilisation. And it actually says, in a national emergency, certain selected reservists will be required to rejoin for service immediately and without waiting for the notice of recall to military service. And that would be on publication of a government announcement, newspaper, poster or broadcast. And then we had to use our ticket and go down to Lee Metford Camp. rather pointedly, it didn't have any rank, so presumably you went in as a private again, back in. And I was in there them until they went to Gibraltar. I can't remember what year they went to Gibraltar, but I then was transferred to Rimi. And finally, I had a letter saying that on the 13th of March 1964, all your commitments for military service are finished, and please send back your papers. And of course, this blue slip I have here, it had to be destroyed, but of course I never did, I kept it. But the rather strange thing is about the travel warrant and paper and what have you that I got from 4th Queen's was, you had to hand that back when you completed your service. Well, being a sergeant, I had the battalion orders, book and what have you, all BOs and what have you. And I thought I'd put this wretched thing inside there. I was convinced I'd slipped it inside there and given it to the QM. He just took it and didn't look inside. And about 10 years later, I found this down the back of a bookcase where it had slipped down the back and slipped underneath and got lost because there was a bit of a to and fro in of letters and what have you from the adjutant asking where his travel warrant was, and me saying, well, your QM's got it. And in fact, he hadn't. It was down the back of the bookcase. It really was a genuine mistake. I didn't intentionally do that. So after about 20 years, well, 19 and a quarter years, from the 2nd of December 1944, when I joined the 7th Cadet Battalion, Middlesex, I finished in 1964. 13th of March 1964, that was the end of my military service. And of course, military wise, went into obscurity. Incidentally, during this period, of course, we'd had the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 62. It was a very worrying time, of course, anybody who lived through that wouldn't have to think too hard to see how worrying that was. And I must say, the old stomach gave a couple of turns, and I used to go off each morning to work, and my wife would stick by the radio virtually all day, listening to it, expecting, of course, a call for us to go. That was the most worrying thing, really, because, I mean, we'd been, during my second stint with the TA, most of it had been, in the early days, it had been air raid precautions thing, we were trained into what would happen in a nuclear war, which there were some unpleasant things that we were going to have to do. That, well, those who obviously survived the business would have to do, and you knew you were going to have to go off and leave your family to suffer accordingly. So it was a very, very worrying time, that. So as I say, my wife kept the radio on all day, and she would have rung me up at work if the word had come, and I would have just dropped everything and gone off to Lee Metford camp.
What things would you have had to do in the event of nuclear war?
Well, one of the most unpleasant things was, of course, there were going to be enormous amounts of casualties, and these are going to be collected at special collection points, and where they would... they had to be dealt with, and I mean, it was a case of, they were obviously, the only way to deal with them would have been to put them out of their misery, you know, to shoot them, put them out of their misery. It was a very trying time, really, because there were three things that you did, three on the civil defence course. You did, apart from, of course, the wreck, and, you know, getting people casualties and things like that, and first aid and all the rest of it. There was the fact that biological warfare was one of the things that we talked about, and there was no defence against that whatsoever. And so that was a bad enough thing. That was probably the worst one, really, because there was no defence. There was gas in all in descending order. There was gas, nerve gas, and the teaching at that time for the infantry was that by the time, if you're in the middle of an attack and you suddenly realise there's nerve gas, don't stop, just go on and do whatever damage you can, because you had to, a file which you had to get out of your, presumably your map pocket, I suppose you kept it, and stab this wretched thing in your leg and pump it in, and then you had a good, had a fair chance of survival, but you'd have been completely out of action for about 3 weeks, providing the thing worked. But if you were just going into the attack, the teaching was, don't bother, just go on, because you're dead anyway, you know, your exhilaration of it all. And then, of course, there was the nuclear, which was going to destroy whole areas, you know, 14 or 15 miles round, or whatever the distances were. They weren't quite so big as they are now, these bombs. And there was no real defence against it. I mean, they talked about getting in the bottom of your slit trench and brown paper would stop you from the flash, but of course, I mean, you'd have to have been a fair old way from the epicentre to have been safe from that. Very worrying times, I think, for everybody, not just those of us who were involved in any service life. I mean, my nephew was an apprentice at working for Hawker Siddeley, and they demonstrated fully what was going to happen if atomic weapons were used, because he went home and told his mum, who I'd already said, oh, don't worry about it, there's no real problem, it was only like a big bang and what have you. Because he went home and told his mum, and she was a bit upset that I tried to pull the wool over her eyes, but isn't it frightening people? Doesn't do a lot of good, I don't think. And anyway, as I say, hard times, but we all got through them all. Everybody who was alive in that time got through them all. And that's about an end to it, I guess, really.
Can I ask you one or two questions about things you said earlier?
Yeah.
You mentioned your comrade Ken in Korea.
Yes.
Did he survive?
Yes. That's funny, really. But I heard no more about it. After Korea, I literally forgot about it. I didn't really want to know about it or think about it or do anything about it. And I had heard a rumour from somebody somewhere along the way that he had survived, but was paralysed down one side. And I didn't really want to make an effort to see him, because I knew it well. I had a fair idea of how he'd been hit. And I felt a bit embarrassed, really, because when I was told he was hit in the head, I thought he was dead. I mean, a headshot, and his brain hanging out, it didn't sound much chance, which is why we didn't go out and bring him in straight away. Anyway, a number of years later, in fact, whilst I was in the TA, I was taking a draft down to Purbright to shoot, and we went by train, and I had the ticket and all the rest of it, and I was the last one out. And the ticket collector was the chap who we thought probably fired the LMG, or not probably fired, did fire the LMG, who may well have hit Ken. You could never say shots were coming from all directions. It might have been him, it might have been the North Koreans up on the hill there. And he was, my platoon's formed up, and the corporals are marching it off, and I can see the back of my platoon whistling off down the road, and poor old, I know his name, was saying to me, I shot him. I said, no, you didn't shoot him. It was the gooks up on the hill that shot him. You missed. You were never a very good shot. And whistled off down the road, and I've never seen that guy again. But sometime later, see, about 1980, the Middlesex Korean Club began to be formed, and he turned up at one of the do's we had. And he was, by this time, he was working for the Red Cross. He was also a councillor for some coastal town, Eastbourne or somewhere like that. And he was able to walk with the aid of a stick. And we had a jolly good old yarn. It was very nice to see him. And funny enough, of course, he'd done the thing they all do. He'd married his nurse. So he was, they were very happily married and had been for, I don't know, probably 15, 20 years or something. Unfortunately, very shortly after that, he caught up with him and he died. But he had about, I guess, 20 or 30 years of life after that. So, yes, we should have got out there quicker, I think, to him. And would have done. First of all, I didn't know where he was, of course. I went to the wrong place where I thought he'd been shot. And, in fact, Had we couldn't see it from there, but four platoon, had he not been lying straight along underneath this paddy bun, they would have seen him anyway. But we didn't, so he's gone now, Ken. So his wife, funny enough, just recently in the regimental journal, somebody was writing that they went, I forget what the story was now, but they went to somewhere, and this lady had a picture of a soldier in jungle green on the wall. She said, "Who's that?" And she said, "Oh, that's my husband, Ken Sutton. He was wounded in Korea and is now dead." And she's I think she's a matron or something in an old people's home, something along those lines. It's in the regimental journal, but I can't really remember what she was. But I wrote to her, obviously, on it. In fact, I sent him a map showing him where he was wounded, not, of course, adding in the bit about where he might have been shot by her own. And he was very, very pleased with that. And I wrote to her when he died, but I didn't get an answer. And one wouldn't expect it, because she had so many letters to answer. That's the Ken Sutton story.
You said about the KSLI taking over, mm. and how you said you kept away from them.
Yes.
Why did you keep away from them?
We didn't keep it. We were kept away from them. We were kept, you know, isolated from them. And I mean, there wasn't much time, you'll appreciate. I mean, a matter of maybe an hour or something like that. But it seemed the policy to keep us away from the new people coming in. And in fact, they apparently, there was an article in one of their magazines just shortly after, how surprised they were to find that all these vehicles in a line, you know, laid out in the open, and all these tents in straight lines and what have you. Because they weren't air tents, they were the one, they'd been put up to help them, to give them a bit of cover when they arrived, by the people who were staying behind. There were a good many staying behind who hadn't got in the 6 month service. And the vehicles had only just been lined up there, because a lot of them were Russian and stolen American ones and stuff like that, but just purely for counting purposes. But they made quite a big issue of that. Apparently they've had the impression this is how we'd gone on all along. As it happened, though, of course, the new brigade did go on like this. They did have tents in straight lines and things like that. But 27 had never been like that at all. Not during, you know, Brigadier Code's time. And Colonel Mann's time, of course. But the new COs come. There's always new people come along, aren't they, you know? And, of course, from then on, they all look much smarter, don't they? If you look at the photographs of them, they're all looking pretty tidy, whilst we look more or less like tramps with holes in our clothing or what have you.
But what was the rationale behind keeping them away from you?
I think it was just, I don't know. I really don't know. Well, because we were anxious to get away, you'll appreciate, because they came in, got off the trucks. There was I guess there was no more than half an hour to an hour. We got on the trucks and went off. I mean, I don't think they really, perhaps they didn't keep them away from us, but, you know, there was no, usually, like when we passed through 29 Brigade up at Pyongyang and back in, would have been about 5th of December or something like that, there was, they rushed out and welcomed us, but there wasn't this sort of movement between the people that were coming in. I guess, I think mainly, of course, if the truth were known, we all thought we were veterans and these are the new boys coming in, you know, and perhaps it was Air Force, perhaps we all thought we were a bit above it all. You never are, of course, but you can get that sort of impression, think that you're the guys that know it all. But I really don't know why that was. But I think it was just a coincidence, really. And some of the people that were staying were not as long serving as some of us. So the senior people that were staying were not, like a platoon commander who had been a sergeant, who was completely and utterly useless. But he stayed behind. And so it might have been him sort of, in our particular case, operating, pulling the strings and keeping us away from the KSLI.
You were talking about the formation of that assault section.
Yes.
And how you said your comrades welcomed it.
Mm.
I was a bit surprised.
Well, I was as well.
That should be their attitude.
Yes, I was very surprised. I didn't expect it at all. I was astonished by what happened. I went and told them that they were disbanding the company commander had decided to disband the platoon, and they were very disappointed at that, and there was a lot of chat about that. I said to them, well, I'm going to form an assault section, and you know, I'm looking for volunteers. And immediately, seven sections said, you know, the survivors of seven sections said, well, we're your section, we've got to come. And I said, well, fair enough then. And then Bill came up and said, who was a corporal, section commander, you'd appreciate, Lance Corporal, who should have been promoted to corporal and never was in career, he was later, a well-deserving case. And he came up and said, well, I'm going to be your second in command. And I said, well, no, I don't, Bill, because you should go off to another platoon where we were short of section commanders. You could get your two tapes, and you know you've had a well. He'd been a section commander since just after the Nacton days when Tupper Brown was wounded, and he was he had it for a short time then, and I took over. But it had been from October when George Potts was wounded, he actually got a section, and ever since he'd been a section commander. Really first class one. In fact, I tried to get him promoted a couple of times without success, and you know, by asking the various platoon commanders if they put a word in for him. I was amazed. I was absolutely amazed. I had no trouble whatsoever. I had a section of 10 people, the best second in command I could have ever have asked for. And as I say, we sat around there, and as I say, the brigadier wouldn't hear of it, and said he'd send us up this sergeant, and to be platoon commander, and I'd be acting platoon sergeant, and also commander in the section as well. And we reformed the platoon that evening when Major Allen came back and told us the news. But I must say, I was astounded when they. In fact, those who were disappointed, the ones who we couldn't get into the section, were very disappointed. And it was amazing. I was absolutely astounded. I couldn't believe it, because it seemed to me the very term assault section was fairly significant, that his intention was to use us for what the word said. But I had no trouble whatsoever. Bit like the old lifeboat when it turns over and all the crew are killed, and you get so many volunteers come up that it absolutely amazes you. Surprising. Good.